Well, thank you, and thank you all for a very warm welcome here. It's been very nice to come. So frustration is a familiar concept in which a system can't satisfy all of its pairwise interactions simultaneously. And what that means is that the minimum energy of the system doesn't correspond to the minimum energy of each of these pairwise interactions. Now, I've paraphrased a rather standard diagram showing this, where I've used fruit to indicate the case of perhaps Ising moments on a triangular lattice interacting antiferromagnetically, where I can satisfy one of the antiferromagnetic interactions very happily, but clearly the third spin, which I'm going to put on here, is under constraint. It could point in either direction, and whichever direction I choose, I haven't satisfied all of the pairwise interactions at the same time. Is this thing working, or shall I just... That's good, okay. So, what I'm going to talk about... Is that a little better? Adjust my clothing. What I'm going to talk about are geometrically frustrated lattices, which we decorate not with real pairs, but with magnetic pairs or spin dimers. And these are systems, then, where you have an antiferromagnetic interaction between pairs of moments that gives you a singlet ground state, and we're going to use a magnetic field to close the spin gap to the excited magnetic states. And the idea is to look at the nature of the long-range magnetic order that results in these systems. And I'm going to talk explicitly about two particular materials. The first is barium copper silicate. This is based on a body-centered tetragonal lattice. And the second is barium manganate. That's based on a triangular lattice. Both of these are manifestly geometrically frustrated lattices. Before I do that, I should tell you who's really been doing these experiments. This is really the thesis work of two students. One, Suchitra Sebastian, has graduated and is currently at Cambridge. And the second, Eric Samuelon, is a current student. We've had worked with a number of undergraduate students at Stanford as well. And this work is in very close collaboration with a number of characters from the High Magnetic Field Lab, specifically Marcelo Jaime, Ross McDonald, Neil Harrison, and Louis Balikas. The theory that's going to underpin what I'll tell you about has been worked out by Christian Batista, also at Los Alamos, and Jörg Schmalian from Ames Laboratory. We've worked closely with some people on numerical simulations. I'll show you some crystallography data from Zahir Islam, a little neutron scattering from Christian Rueg, Matt Stone, and Mark Lumsden. And I'll at least mention some EPR work by Steve Hill and some NMR work by Stuart Brown. And this work is supported by the NSF. So what I'll talk about now is just part of a slightly bigger research program, which is looking at new materials, and specifically new materials with unconventional magnetic or electronic properties. And specifically, we work in a number of areas. One is quantum magnetism, so I'll tell you a little about this. Other areas are superconductivity and the physics of low-dimensional materials. And these are just some of the phase diagrams that one comes up with, some of our either materials du jour, the materials we currently care about, or whatever. But the point I want to make is, if you want to look at this range of different materials, you've got to have a strength in crystal growth. And this is one of the defining features of what we do. And these are some of the different materials that we've looked at over the course of the last few years. Now, we use a number of techniques. You've got to pick what's the sensible technique for the particular material that you want to grow. And for the materials that I'm going to talk about today, barium copper silicate and barium manganate, I'll at least give you a sense of how we go about synthesizing these. Very good. So what I want to do is first give you a short introduction to spin dimer compounds, and specifically, what are they and why might we care about these materials? And then secondly, I want to talk about my two frustrated pairs, which is the barium copper silicate with the BCT lattice and barium manganate with the triangular lattice. I don't want to stretch a point with my fruit analogy. This is the last time I'm going to show you a pair. But if we're going to talk about interacting pairs, we better first understand a single pair, a single magnetic dimer. Okay, all of the systems we're looking at, these pairs are interacting antiferromagnetically with each other. The Hamiltonian that describes this is very simple, right? And you know exactly what the ground state and excited state is of this Hamiltonian. It's going to be a singlet ground state and a triplet excited state. And that triplet state can split linearly in a magnetic field. And you can calculate the low field properties of this system just by thermally populating these states. It's actually kind of a nice sort of solid state physics problem to go through. For instance, the susceptibility follows this form and looks like this, where there's an exponential rise in the susceptibility at low temperatures corresponding to thermally populating across the spin gap here. Similar results in the heat capacity, etc. Now, when we talk about the high field behavior of these, and you'll see curves like this shortly as we look at the real materials. When you talk about the high field property of these sort of materials, that's really saying, well, when this SE equals one triplet comes down and crosses the singlet. And at T equals zero, for non-interacting dimers, that would give me a magnetic moment per whatever it is, per copper, which jumps from zero to one Bohr magneton instantaneously at that critical field. And at higher temperatures, I'm just going to get thermal broadening due to thermal population of these states, which I've shown here. But the question that you'd like to ask is, well, what happens if you have weakly interacting dimers? Now, we can get a lot of insight for this from the two-leg ladder, which is a system which has been considered theoretically extensively. And specifically, each of my little green dots here now is going to be a spin. Let's talk about spin 1/2 to start with. And they're connected, and I'm only considering nearest neighbor exchange interactions here. And the Hamiltonian, which is going to describe this system, is very straightforward. It consists of a sum of terms of the rungs of the ladder, here they are, a sum of terms of the legs of the ladder, here they are, and a sum of terms from the Z-Mann energy of each one of these spins individually. Now, the particular sort of material we're considering here of dimer compounds are in the limit where J, my intra-dimer coupling, is larger than J prime, the coupling between these dimers. That's my choice of the sort of material I'm going to look at. But because of making that choice, we can treat this Hamiltonian perturbatively, which means that we can make our new eigenstates from linear combinations of the original eigenstates, which are my singlet and triplet states. And so you can treat this in a number of ways. Perhaps the simplest is to consider the case of a field that's large enough to have brought down the SE equals one triplet, so it's almost degenerate with the singlet state. I'm going to just treat these two states now in my problem, and I can even represent these by a pseudospin 1/2 if I want to do that, where my pseudospin is up if I have the triplet or down if I have the singlet. But it's a two-state problem. And you can transform this Hamiltonian into a set of operators which then act on these singlets and triplets, and that's what I've done here. Now, the only point I would mention is the SX and SY components in this effective Hamiltonian can be written in terms of the raising and lowering operators, S plus and S minus. This is a standard trick that you see in other contexts. And what that's telling me is if I take a ladder which is full of singlets and I put one triplet on it, let's say I put a triplet right here, these terms are going to delocalize that triplet. They'll cause it to hop around on this lattice. And as soon as I have a delocalized excitation, it's going to have a dispersion relation associated with it. It's even got a name. You can call it a triplon because it comes from a triplet. So I would go from the situation of having a non-dispersing band centered at J if I had non-interacting triplets to a dispersing band where the bandwidth is essentially determined by here by J prime, the interdimer coupling. The spin gap, which is the gap to the minimum energy excitation, is now smaller than it was before. And if I were to use a bond operator formalism, but which treats all three triplets, then I could do, you'll just find that all three triplet bands are broadened in the same way. And these three triplet bands will split linearly in a field, just like the original triplet states do. And when this point crosses zero, well, that's when you begin to develop a magnetization. But now my magnetization isn't going to jump to one Bohr magneton instantaneously. I've got to bring the rest of this band down through the singlet before I get the full magnetization out of the system. And so even at T equals zero, I'm going to have a magnetization which rises slowly until I finally saturate this and all the spins are pointing in the same direction. Right. There's not going to be any long-range order here. There's no room for cooperative physics. There's no magnetism here, no long-range order. But between this critical field and this critical field, we can anticipate long-range magnetic order. And that's the interesting place. Now, you can make another transformation to this Hamiltonian. It's called a Jordan-Wigner transformation. Doesn't really matter. But you can map this onto a Hamiltonian in which I have a series of bosons. These are simply my triplets. They carry spin one. That's why they're a boson. There's a hardcore constraint. They're hardcore bosons. That's just because I can't have more than one triplet on a side. So if you like, there's a strong repulsive interaction between these triplets. But the point is, the kinetic energy of these triplets is coming from the XY component in this effective Hamiltonian. The potential energy of the triplets is coming from the Z component in this Hamiltonian. And the chemical potential of the triplets is coming from my magnetic field. So you end up with a realization of a lattice gas of hardcore bosons for which the magnetic field controls the chemical potential. Now, as soon as you do that, this thing can only do two things at t equals zero. It can either condense or it can crystallize. It'll crystallize if the potential energy is the dominant term. Triplets want to repel away from each other. Or it'll condense if the kinetic energy dominates, if the XY component dominates. All right. The crystallization corresponds then to triplets forming some commensurate lattice on my original crystal lattice, repelling away from each other. And the canonical example of this is the Shastri-Sutherland compound strontium copper borate. The condensate, well, I got to think a little about what that means. A condensate then would be a coherent mixture of the singlet and triplet on each individual site with a specific phase factor in between, corresponding to the ordering wave vector, actually. Now, in terms of magnetism, this doesn't give me a whole lot of insight. But if you calculate the x, y, and z, the expectation values of the x, y, and z components of the spin, you'll find out what this is really doing for the individual moments. And what this corresponds to is a cantered antiferromagnet, in which the components of the spins on each dimer are oriented so the x and y components are in the opposite direction, and they're tipped up in the direction of the magnetic field. It's a cantered antiferromagnet. And these spins could have pointed anywhere on a on an axis around the dimer axis. And in fact, if you also calculate the expectation value of spins on adjacent sites, you find that the spins are alternating here for a square lattice, so they're pointing in opposite directions in both the x and y direction. In fact, the ordering wave vector, which in this case is pi pi, corresponds then to a macroscopic occupancy of the minimum of my original triplet band. The triplet density is just given by the magnetization or the expectation value of the z component of the spin, and the amplitude of your order parameter is the staggered magnetization, the in-plane magnetization. Remember, this is the case where the XY component of the effective Hamiltonian is dominated, so I get an XY antiferromagnet. And the phase here corresponds to the angle of the spins in the plane. You've spontaneously broken a continuous axial symmetry. Okay, that's what you need to have for a Bose-Einstein condensate. And the canonical example of this is thallium copper chloride. Oh, and I should mention there is, of course, one other possibility here, which would be the spin analog of a supersolid, so a spin supersolid, where you would have both a spontaneous crystallization of the lattice, and if you could tune the chemical potential just slightly away from this commensurate filling so that you're able to introduce a few additional triplets, which are then able to run around on this lattice, you'd have then both simultaneous crystallinity, ordered triplets, and a condensate. And there's no candidate for this as yet. All right. So why study spin-dimer compounds, particularly someone like myself, a materials person, for goodness sake? So first of all, you can access lattice gas models which would be unphysical for a simple antiferromagnet. And let me be real specific about that. We care about the limit of weak spin-orbit coupling because we want to have a spontaneously broken U1 symmetry. And if I have strong spin-orbit coupling, that's going to cause moments to point in specific directions. That means I'd have to work with 3D elements. But if I'm working with 3D elements, I can't get a strong anisotropy in my effective Hamiltonian. Well, you can here. You can engineer a strong anisotropy, a strong exchange anisotropy, just by the way that the dimers are arranged with respect to each other. So that means you can potentially access some very unusual quantum phases of matter, including potentially this spin supersolid. Second reason. So this is what you just can't do with a simple antiferromagnet. These systems are tunable by the magnetic field. That means you can explore the entire quantum phase diagram. And we'll see diagrams like this. This is temperature versus field. Here's the quantum paramagnetic state, my singlet state, just short-range correlations, no long-range order. Here's my ordered state, my XY antiferromagnet. And here's my saturated paramagnet. But you can go across the entire phase diagram, including looking at the quantum critical points here. The third reason sounds awfully technical, but I'm going to put it up anyway because it is important, and I'll come back to it. These systems are protected against symmetric anisotropies, and hopefully by the time I finish, you'll understand what I mean about that. But it means that terms like this in my effective Hamiltonian, they can only mix singlet and triplet states and therefore break this beautiful sort of mixture of singlets and triplets to second order. And that means that terms which break the axial symmetry are suppressed relative to a simple antiferromagnet. And as I say, I'm going to come back to that. But it's another thing you just can't do with a simple antiferromagnet, and that's what makes these dimer systems especially important and different. And lastly, I finally get to put my materials hat on. There are very few candidate materials. So this is a wide open area with some very well worked out theories and very few materials which you can apply these to. That's what's attractive to someone like me. Okay, so I'm going to talk about magnetic order in two systems which are geometrically frustrated. This is barium copper silicate and barium manganate. And from the get-go, here's showing the susceptibility versus temperature for both of these. You can see these are dimer systems. The red lines to the data here are fits to dimer models, the same models that I was showing you at the beginning. From these fits, you can get various parameters, doesn't matter. Barium copper silicate consists of vertical dimers arranged on a square lattice, but the 3D lattice has a body center tetragonal symmetry. So there's a half-half translation wave vector. Here's the next square plaquette shifted over underneath. Barium manganate consists of vertical dimers on a triangular lattice, where again, the next dimer up is centered over the middle of the plaquette above or below. And you might guess that a triangular lattice is going to be more frustrated, if I can somehow say more or less frustrated, than a square lattice. That's actually what we thought as we started out. It's not the case, and that's going to be kind of one of the messages, the take-home messages from this. This lattice ends up being more frustrated than this lattice. I said we work on new materials. That's not quite fair. At least barium copper silicate is 2,000 years old. It's an anthropogenic pigment, a man-made pigment. This is what's used to color the terracotta warriors, for instance. It's a bilayer member of a family that consists also of some single layer copper silicate sheets, which are Egyptian blue and Chinese blue. Egyptian blue is like 4,000 years old. This stuff is dead easy to make. Take calcium carbonate, limestone, quartz, silicon dioxide, and anything with copper in, and you get this phase because that's the only material in the phase diagram. The Egyptians had it easy. The Chinese did something more complicated. There are actually four different compounds in this phase diagram. Four compounds. And you've got to get the stoichiometry just right, and you've got to get your temperatures just right to get the right phase. We know that because it's been a real bugbear to get crystals of this. So you've got to hand it to the ancient chemists that they really understood a lot more about chemistry than perhaps we first realized. Just a word about the crystal growth. So barium copper silicate, we were quite proud of this actually. The archaeological samples, there's evidence of lead in them. And that implies that they were possibly using either lead or lead oxide as a flux to grow these crystals. And so we used that as a starting point when we began to make this material. And indeed, lead oxide works as a very good flux to grow crystals of barium copper silicate. It turns out, though, lead oxide is a rather aggressive flux for a number of reasons, and so we prefer to use lithium metaborate, but that doesn't matter. You can grow crystals of this from a flux. Barium manganate, well, barium manganate really is a new material by any standards. If you look at the valences here, by the way, manganese is in a 5-plus state. That's a very unusual valence for manganese, and it requires a strongly oxidizing flux to grow this, and we find that sodium hydroxide works especially well. Okay, so here's finally the crystal structure of barium copper silicate. Here you're looking at the unit cell from the side. The material consists of infinite copper silicate sheets separated here by these barium ions. So it's a quasi-two-dimensional material. This diagram, I've just taken this and I've flipped it over so you're looking down on one of these copper silicate sheets. The red here, the red atoms are the copper atoms. It's copper 2+, that's 3D9 spin 1/2. And the green atoms are just the barium sitting above and below. And you can see here, well, maybe you can't, but there are two copper square planar coppers just twisted slightly with respect to each other. That's your dimer. Here are those two atoms again. They're linked by just one of these SiO4 groups, whereas whereas adjacent dimers are linked by two of these groups. And so even just looking at this lattice, you might guess that this system might be dimerized. let's see what's to say. Oh, by the way, a chemist looks at this. A chemist looks at this and says, ah, this is a four-member cyclosilicate group. That's a rather funky thing in its own right, joined by these rather boring copper ions. A physicist looks at this and says, ah, you've got these very interesting magnetic dimers joined by these rather boring cyclosilicate groups. So it's a matter of which hat you put on as to how you'd look at this material. In any regard, we understand what the exchange couplings are in this system based on inelastic neutron scattering measurements from Christian Rueck. The intradimer exchange is about 5 millivolts, about 50 Kelvin. The interdimer in-plane exchange between these is about half a millivolt, a factor of 10 smaller. And the C-axis coupling is about a factor of 10 smaller again. So you've got this lovely division of energy scales. And this results then in a spin gap, the minimum energy of the triplet dispersion, of about 3 millivolts. That gives you a critical field of about 23 Tesla. That sounds big, but it's eminently accessible. Now, we should have some truth in advertising before I go any further. Barium copper silicate has a perfect body-centered tetragonal structure at room temperature. But one of the first things that we discovered is actually there's a weak orthorhombic distortion at about 100 Kelvin. Weak because the separation here between the A and B axis directions is very small. And actually, in its own regard, that doesn't particularly damage the frustration, but it's accompanied by an incommensurate lattice modulation. These are the incommensurate satellites multiplied up by, I think, four orders of magnitude. It's presumably driven by a rigid rotation of these SiO4 groups. That's actually what makes this sort of interesting to a chemist. These silicon atoms are seeking their perfect bonding angles and bond lengths in the environment of this structure. But we'll never have a complete structural model for this because this is such a weak modulation. You can't possibly do a full crystallographic refinement. You can't collect enough peaks to do that. So we'll never know exactly what the structure is. It's just a subtle distortion of this BCT structure. But the point is, this is an extremely subtle effect, and it doesn't affect the subsequent analysis. And what I mean explicitly about that is any weak, non-frustrated component of the coupling of the exchange between planes is going to appear on an energy scale that's lower than our base temperatures. So it just doesn't end up affecting things. But this is the sort of the truth in advertising statement of the lattice is based on a BCT lattice, but is subtly distorted. All right, so the high field measurements that I'm going to show you were done together with Marcelo Jaime and Neil Harrison at the high field lab. Here are some magnetization data as a function of field. In high temperatures, you have thermal population of the triplet states. When you go to low temperatures to half a Kelvin here, you see this very sharp onset of magnetization as you close the spin gap, as this triplet dispersion is brought down through the singlet. And if you then take the system at some field before this saturates, like here 36 Tesla, and cool it down, here's the heat capacity as a function of temperature, you see a beautiful lambda anomaly corresponding to the onset of long-range magnetic order in this system. And the question that you'd want to ask is, well, does this correspond to the BEC of triplets that you might conceive of theoretically? And you can address that by looking at, well, you can't address this by doing scattering measurements in a field like this, but you can address this by looking at the critical scaling exponents, which are then characteristic of the universality class of the system. And specifically, you might look at the thermal phase transition, which you know scales according to some exponent as you approach the critical temperature. But this is a famously difficult exponent to measure for the Bose-Einstein universality class because the exponent is extremely small, 0.01. And there's no way from these data you'd be able to do that. You have to get very, very close to TC reliably to do that. But there's another exponent that one can measure. And that's the exponent which describes how TC varies relative to the field due to the quantum phase transition. And this exponent takes a value of 2 divided by the dimensionality of the system. We'll see what that dimensionality is in a moment. And that's in contrast to the competing phases, which would essentially be Ising phases, meaning moments confined to point in specific directions by some anisotropy. And this is a distinction that one can make experimentally very easily. So one's job comes down to determining TC as a function of H, remember this phase diagram with this hump where you've got the long-range order, at the quantum critical point, or approaching the quantum critical point. And this is where both measurements of the magnetocaloric effect and also the magnetization essentially become relevant. So first, magnetocaloric effect. Here, this is the temperature of the sample as a function of field. You sweep the field, keeping the sample essentially decoupled from its environment. So its entropy has to stay constant. It's a constant entropy experiment. And as you go from the disordered to the ordered state, the sample's becoming more ordered, its entropy's going down, that means its temperature has to go up. And so the phase boundary is delineated by a sharp increase in the temperature of the sample. Now, in the magnetization, here measured by the torque, you can also deduce where the phase boundary is from discontinuities in derivatives of the magnetization. And that's what's shown here. This is a discontinuity in the second derivative. There are technical reasons why you would choose that particularly. And between these two measurements and the heat capacity, you can put points on this phase diagram, and that's the phase diagram I showed on the very first slide. So the blue region is the disordered region. The yellow region is the ordered region. This is the long-range magnetic order here. There's no long-range magnetic order. And there's a sufficient number of data points here that one could now do a two-parameter fit to this, which is giving me the slope of the phase boundary as you approach the quantum critical point, and therefore you can determine this exponent, and that'll tell you what the universality class is. So here then, these are the results here of this two-parameter fit. The x-axis here is the center of the sliding window, which is sliding down here, and the different data points are just different widths to that window, just to make sure that we're not confused by anything. And what you see is that as you cool down and as you begin to enter the region where you expect universal behavior, and we can tell where that is from these numerical simulations that Naiki Kawashima was able to run. First, you reach a region where the exponent is given by the 3D BEC universality class. That's an exponent of 2/3. That wasn't so surprising. The real surprise was to find that crossed over to an exponent of 1. That corresponds, if you remember, the exponent is 2 divided by the dimensionality. That implies that this is a 2D quantum critical point in this manifestly three-dimensional material. So this raises a... Oh, and this scaling is observed for well over a decade of reduced field. So this raises the very interesting question of, if I have individual triplets which can move in 3 dimensions, we know they can, from the inelastic neutron scattering, there's a finite bandwidth in this direction, why is the collective behavior at the quantum critical point in just 2 dimensions? So we can get a lot of insight for this just by considering the dispersion relation for a perfect BCT lattice. And specifically, if I first look at the dispersion relation just for the square lattice, sort of starting at the highest energy scales, well, actually, that's just 2 interpenetrating 2-leg ladders, actually. And that gives me then, and you can calculate these dispersion relations just like you would for electrons in a solid by a tight binding type model. But this gives me just 2 cosine bands, and I've sketched this here. These are then the 2 cosine bands for the kx and ky directions. If you then turn on the interlayer hopping or coupling with this exchange constant here, which you call jf for frustrated, then you find that the hopping in the z direction, has some value, but is modulated by the in-plane wave vector. And what that means is, if I draw in color here, what the interlayer hopping is, where 0 is red and blue is some big value, the interlayer hopping goes identically to 0 at the minimum of the triplet dispersion relation. That means that if I had non-interacting triplets, then at t equals 0, all of these particles would be in the condensate, which is at the minimum of the triplet dispersion, which is at pi pi in this particular case. But I know that there's no interlayer hopping for this particular wave vector. Therefore, you end up with independent two-dimensional condensates. Now, lest there be any mystery here, this is just from geometric frustration. So if you look down on one of the square plaquettes making up this structure, the in-plane ordering wave vector is pi pi. Remember, this is an XY antiferromagnet. Don't let this language of Bose-Einstein condensate confuse anything. We're talking about an antiferromagnet. And it's a canted XY antiferromagnet. That's my pi pi ordering wave vector. And what that means is, as I go up to the next layer up, it's a body-centered tetragonal lattice, so the next layer up is shifted by half-half. here's part of that square. This ion is completely under-constrained. It gets no information about which direction it should be pointing in. And what that means is the next layer up will also have a pi-pi ordering wave vector, but the relative phase of these layers is completely arbitrary, is not determined. Now, those of you who are familiar with this should be crying out at this point, what about order from disorder? What about the effect of thermal fluctuations or even quantum fluctuations on this? Because this has been shown to break these rather delicate frustrations. And certainly that's the case. If you were to flip one of the spins on this triangular plaquette, here these spins represent the pseudo-spins, but it doesn't matter. This could just be the top of one of the dimers, if you like. If you were to flip one of these spins, either a thermal or a quantum fluctuation, doesn't matter, that breaks the perfect frustration. And that actually restores an effective coupling in the C direction. And it gives you long-range magnetic order. This is order from disorder. And in fact, it's been shown that this gives you an unfrustrated bi-quadratic interlayer coupling, which goes as the density squared of the triplets. It goes as the density squared because this is bi-quadratic. And that restores 3D phase coherence for finite triplet densities. It restores phase coherence for simple antiferromagnets with this structure, and that's in fact what Piers Coleman had shown very recently. But, and here's the big but, or the big important part, at the quantum critical point down here, in these dimer systems, the triplet density has gone to zero. And if the triplet density goes to zero, this coupling goes to zero. And so the quantum critical point itself is a two-dimensional quantum critical point. The fluctuations associated with it are two-dimensional fluctuations. The fixed point, which is determining the scaling, is two-dimensional. And that's why at finite temperatures, even though it's three-dimensional, the exponents that one measures are 2D exponents in a manifestly three-dimensional system. What about this U1 symmetry, meaning axial, continuous axial symmetry that has to be broken if this is going to be a Bose-Einstein condensate? And what effects might break this apparently delicate symmetry? They're going to be broken. It's a crystal, for goodness sake. There has to be some coupling, but which coupling is going to break this symmetry first? What temperature do I have to cool down below before I notice that I'm sitting in a crystal? Well, for barium copper silicate, it turns out that the highest energy effect is from dipolar interactions, magnetic dipoles. These are magnetic dipoles, these moments, and each other moment is sitting in the dipole field of the other moments. The dipolar energy goes as 1 over r cubed, so let me just talk about a single dimer first here. If I have fields along the dimer axis, then, which is sort of implicitly what I've been showing so far, then actually this introduces no anisotropy. And that's because if I have two spins like this, it doesn't matter what the phase is, the dipolar energy is the same. But if I rotate the field to be perpendicular to the dimer axis, so here's my dimer axis, and I apply a field in this direction, I've got a canted XY antiferromagnet, and the X and Y components are opposite to each other. But this and this have a different dipolar energy to this and this. So here, the dipolar energy induces an anisotropy. And that ultimately will break this perfect U1 symmetry. But we've got to ask, what energy scale is that relevant at? Now, this intradimer dipolar coupling does nothing more than cause zero field splitting of the triplet. Here's a sketch, energy versus field. Here's the splitting of the triplet. And if you calculate, even just classically, the dipolar energy of the three triplet states, you'll find that these two are clearly degenerate, but it's different to this dipolar energy. Imagine these as literally just classical magnets. This arrangement gives a different energy to this. That gives you zero field splitting. There are no free parameters in that zero field splitting. It depends just on the separation of the moments and the G factors. And that zero field splitting is about 0.1 Kelvin. And this will enter into the spin Hamiltonian in a term that looks like this. It's called a symmetric anisotropy. The measured zero field splitting, by looking at these two transitions via EPR, this is Steve Hill's work, is exactly 0.1 Kelvin. No free parameters. And actually, you can rule out other anisotropies from other measurements also. Now, that's already a small energy scale. But actually, that's not the relevant energy scale for breaking of this perfect symmetry. And you can see that because the a term like this can't mix singlets and triplets directly. The singlet is antisymmetric, the triplet is symmetric, so there aren't any matrix elements connecting these. So this term can't mix singlets and triplets. It can't break this beautiful coherent mixture of the singlet and triplet, which is this Bose-Einstein condensate. If you like, but what I have to do is consider to figure out this sort of the effect of anisotropy energy, you've got to consider second order terms. You've got to involve the inter-dimer coupling. And specifically then, that involves other states. In fact, it involves this state here, because this term mixes this triplet and this triplet, and then that involves this higher energy state. And in a second order process, I can bring that back using the inter-dimer coupling, J primed. And so actually, this anisotropy energy becomes relevant only in second order, in which case it's protected, if you like, by the higher energy state, which is an energy J above this. And so this energy scale of 0.1 Kelvin is actually reduced to about 10 millikelvin, and that will be the gap to the Goldstone mode in this system. And that's why the measurements that I showed you, which were just down to 30 millikelvin, gave exponents that are consistent with Bose-Einstein condensation. Even though this is manifestly going to be anisotropic at some energy scale, this is the energy scale, the maximum energy scale, where you would begin to see that effect. So that was one of the points I made at the beginning. The axial symmetry required for Bose-Einstein condensation in these systems is remarkably robust or protected relative to what you would have in a simple antiferromagnet. In a simple antiferromagnet, this energy scale would set that. All right. In the context of what we've learned about barium copper silicate, what on earth is going to happen when we now come to the triangular lattice? So the triangular lattice, you might well think, is more frustrated than the square lattice here. Let's see what happens. So here's the crystal structure of barium manganate. I've been kind to you. I've taken out the barium ions. So the red dots are the manganese. They're tetrahedrally coordinated. And the dimers are arranged here on a triangular lattice. This is just showing two parts of that triangular lattice. And as I say, the next layer up, the dimer is centered over the middle of a triangle, and the next layer down centered under the middle of a dimer too. The manganese has a 5 plus valence. That's 3d2. Go to your periodic table. That's a spin 1. And we've seen already from the susceptibility, this is going to be a dimer compound. OK, barium manganate brings three twists to this tail. The first twist is obviously the in-plane frustration, meaning I've now got an antiferromagnetic in-plane interaction on a triangular lattice. That's going to do something different. The second is it brings in single ion anisotropy. And I thought I'd add just a quick comment on that. So we know, or you know, that for a 3D ion, spin orbit coupling quenches the angular momentum. So for a 3D ion, you're looking at spin only. But there is always some residual spin-orbit interaction, and you can treat this perturbatively. And when you do that, you find two things. First, you get G anisotropy, which is just to say the G factor depends on the direction in which you're looking. It's actually a very subtle effect and has very little effect in barium manganate. But you also get an anisotropy energy, which is to say that the specific orbitals corresponding, in this case, to SE equals 1, 0, and minus 1, have a different energy depending on their orientation. And if you have an axial symmetry, which is what's relevant here, it contributes a term that looks like this. Again, another symmetric anisotropy in the spin Hamiltonian. This is just saying that the SC equals 1 and minus 1 states have a different energy to the SC equals 0 state. Now, this term has no effect whatsoever for the quantum limit of spin 1/2. Very good. There's actually a fundamental reason for that, which is time reversal symmetry breaking. The crystal field Hamiltonian is time reversal symmetric. I can look at my crystal either direction of time. I've got the same thing. And so it fundamentally can't split the SC equals plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. Requires something like a magnetic field to do that. But I can split this for S equals 1. I can split this into plus minus 1 and 0. And that's what this state does. And we'll see that is a significant effect in the case of this material. So single ion anisotropy. And the third thing that this brings is both, you not only have triplet condensation, or the possibility of triplet condensation, but also that of quintuplet condensation. I have two spin ones. How do you add two spin ones? I get spin 0, 1, and 2. I'll sketch this here. Spin 1 is a triplet, spin 2 is a quintuplet. all three of, well, both of these are split linearly in a field. And both of these are going to be broadened into bands by the interdimer interaction. And so we'll be able to look here first at singlet-triplet condensation, and then here at triplet-quintuplet condensation. So let's see how this goes. So first of all, we know the exchange interactions in barium manganate in gory detail, again, due to some beautiful inelastic neutron scattering measurements, which basically map out these triplon dispersions. And you can fit that then to your dimer models based on all the different exchange constants that you know. And what this gives you is, first, a minimum of the triplet dispersion corresponding to a millivolt. That's about 9 tesla. That's great. This is a very accessible field to close the spin gap. The intradimer coupling is about 1.6 millivolts. That's the highest energy scale of the problem. The in-plane coupling is smaller. The interplane coupling, or the in-plane interdimer coupling, is smaller. The out-of-plane interdimer coupling is smaller still. And I should add that to get a good fit to the triplon dispersion, you have to include not only an interdimer coupling here, J2, but also this cross term, J3. And not only an interdimer term between nearest neighbors, J1, but also between next nearest neighbors, J4. These two terms, these additional ones, don't change the fundamental physics that I'm going to talk about. And so just to keep the equation simple, I'm going to leave these two out. But you can put them in very easily. When you do, you get qualitatively exactly the same thing and a quantitative understanding of the phase diagram. And so in leaving these out, all I'm doing is trying to keep my equation shorter when I show that to you. And lastly, we know the single ion anisotropy. We know that from EPR measurements. And so this material then is a quasi-two-dimensional material with planes of vertical dimers on triangular layers which interact weakly in the perpendicular direction. The triangular analog of Bacuzzi, barium copper silicate. All of our materials get names. We've been working on something called LFAPO recently. So here's the high field behavior. And first, I'm going to talk just about the triplet ordered states. Here's a phase diagram that looks very similar to what I showed you for Bacuzzi, for barium copper silicate, with fields get here in the C direction, so parallel to the dimer axis. Here, we've put points on the phase boundary from magnetocaloric effect measurements. That's what the squiggly lines are. This is just measuring the temperature of the sample as you sweep the field from different starting points. And you can also cut the phase diagram vertically. Here are some heat capacity measurements showing beautiful lambda anomalies with an entropy that grows as you rise towards the middle of the dome here. Now, you can do the same thing for fields oriented perpendicular to the dimer axis. And in this case, something rather unusual happens, which is you get two phase transitions, which show up both for horizontal cuts of the phase transition and also for vertical cuts. Here are the two anomalies in the heat capacity. For this orientation, you can also look, for instance, at the magnetization via torque measurements. This is essentially magnetization. It's really, torque really tells you about anisotropy, but it doesn't matter. This is essentially magnetization. This is field, and this is temperature. So here, this is a field sweep. Here's HC1, and you've got this rapid rise in magnetization, which is then smeared out as you go to higher temperatures. This is 800 millikelvin. This was down here at about 20 millikelvin. And superimposed on this rise, you've got the two clear phase transitions, which you can, again, use to put points on a phase diagram, which are consistent with the MCE data that I just showed you. Nine tesla is a field that one can hope to access much more easily than barium copper silicate, way up there at 23 tesla. So we actually have a hope to directly probe the magnetic structure. Now, so far, we've only got preliminary measurements to do that. But from NMR measurements, these are data from Stuart Brown. The NMR probes here, by the way, the barium ions, I put the bariums back in. This is probing these barium sites. Goes from above this ordered phase diagram having a single peak in the NMR. This is telling you each of those barium is seeing the same environment, so it has the same night shift. Now to having a continuously broadened set of night shifts. That says that each one of these barium ions is seeing a subtly different environment. That's telling you you've got an incommensurate magnetic order, not a commensurate magnetic order. That's verified by neutron scattering, where all we know from the neutron scattering so far is that the in-plane wave vectors are both close to 2/3 pi, but not exactly. It's definitely an incommensurate magnetic structure. And so far, we have no other information. So in the absence of other information, let's go back to an analysis of the spin Hamiltonian to try and get at least a qualitative understanding of the ground states of this system and why you should have an incommensurate magnetic structure. This is not meant to be horrible. The simplest spin Hamiltonian that you can write out for barium manganate is identical to what I showed you for barium copper silicate in that it contains a sum of terms from all of the interactions between the spins, and it contains a Z-man energy, but we have to include the single ion anisotropy. This is the only difference. And you just have to construct this consistent with the specific lattice you're looking at. And the theory for this, by the way, has been worked out by Christian Batista. The effective Hamiltonian you work out when you project this onto the subspace of just the singlet and triplet is then given by this expression. As I say, this looks horrible, but it isn't. These terms, this is the interplane coupling, and this is the in-plane coupling. And what you see here is that the XY component beats out the Z component. I've tried to write it explicitly to show that the Z component must be smaller than the XY, showing it that way. And what that means is that you can anticipate that you're going to have a candid antiferromagnet, just like the other cases. The XY component is beating the Z component. It's going to be a condensate, not a crystal, if you like. That means I'm going to expect something that looks similar to a Heisenberg antiferromagnet on a triangular lattice. So let me very quickly review what you get for the classical ground state of the Heisenberg triangular antiferromagnet. It's the 120-degree structure. You're probably familiar with this. If I consider a single triangular plaquette like this and ask, well, what's the magnetically ordered state going to look like for a Heisenberg antiferromagnet? Well, the energy is the sum of the three pairwise interactions. And you can write this in terms of the square of the sum of the spins, just from mathematics. And the reason for writing it this way is it's obvious then that the energy is minimized when this term adds up to zero. All right, if I have three vectors which have the same length adding up to zero, their relative angles are 120 degrees. That's why the triangular lattice with Heisenberg moments, the classical solution is 120 degree structure. And that corresponds to an ordering wave vector in these directions of two-thirds pi. So we're going to expect something that looks similar to that in this case, just because here the XY component dominates the Z component. These two ugly terms, these are just exchange anisotropy. And this is effectively coming from this term here, which is the single ion anisotropy. And lastly, then, there's just the Z-man energy. Okay, we can treat this the same way as before. You make eigenstates from a linear combination of the singlet and triplet states. For fields in the C direction, these terms go to zero. That's because this is an axial anisotropy. It makes no difference. The XY moments don't care if there's an axis in this direction, which is the easy direction. And so you can make the combinations of singlets and triplets just like we did before. But for fields oriented away from the dimer axis, you have to make a combination of the singlet and triplet, which is a little more complicated. And all these terms are doing is mixing the singlet and triplet in such a way as to give you that anisotropy. And then all that Christian has done here is determine the ground states by minimizing the energy with respect to these parameters. So you're finding the classical ground states. Right. Rather than going through that, let me try and give you a sense of what the solutions are. So first, for fields parallel to the dimer axis. Well, if I had no interlayer coupling, then I know I have a situation where the XY components are doing just what I expect for a Heisenberg antiferromagnet. I'll get 120 degree structure. I've tried to sketch that here. So I have these are canted moments. They're tipped up in the direction of the spin, of the field, but the XY components are 120 degrees with respect to each other. If I now turn on a finite interlayer coupling, what you'll find is that these moments twist around with an angle alpha here, which is slightly different to 120 degrees. And there's a simple reason for that. Centered above the middle of this dimer is the spin on the next layer up, and it's coupled by the same interaction to all three of these. If the total spin on this plaquette is equal to zero, which is what minimizes the in-plane exchange, then I can't benefit from that out-of-plane exchange at all. But if I twist the structure, then I can benefit from that. Now, the cost in energy to the in-plane exchange is quadratic in the deviation from 120 degrees. That's easy to understand. I was already at the minimum energy. Anything I do in terms of the in-plane interaction is going to increase the energy. But the gain in energy due to the out-of-plane coupling when you finally get a net moment on this plaquette is odd with respect to the deviation from 120 degrees and therefore is linear, and a linear term will always beat a quadratic term. And let me try and illustrate that. This is one of the, imagine, this is one of the planes. Here's a particular triangular plaquette. If I had a 120 degree structure, the total spin, which I've shown in blue here, would be zero. But if I twist this instead by some different angle, I get a total spin on this plaquette. And that's what's coupled, it turns out, ferromagnetically to the next layer up. There it is. Now, if I twisted this the wrong way, then I would end up with the moment pointing, the total spin pointing in the other direction, but I have a ferromagnetic interaction between these planes. Therefore, I have something which is odd in whether I twist to one way or another. There's a right way and a wrong way to twist my spiral for a given phase between the different planes. That's why the out-of-plane cost is linear. Linear term will always beat a quadratic term. You're always going to have an incommensurate in-plane magnetic structure. And you can figure out the turn angle. It's a little bit less than 120 degrees. Consistent with what's seen in neutron. What about fields perpendicular to C? Well, let me start by turning off the interplane coupling and also turn off the single player, the single ion anisotropy. So now all I'm going to do is rotate a field from being along the dimer axis to perpendicular to the dimer axis. And in that case, the XY components of the spins are still going to be oriented at 120 degrees with respect to each other. It's the same diagram I had before, just with each of the moments twisted sideways, but still on this triangular plaquette. The sum of the XY components of the spins adds up to zero. That minimizes the in-plane exchange. If I turn on the single ion anisotropy, well, now this is an axial anisotropy. The easy direction is along the dimer axis. And so in the plane perpendicular to the field, in this plane, this direction is easy and this direction is hard. If you like, the moments want to point this way and not that way. But I still want to have a structure which minimizes the total spin, the total XY spin on this triangle. And to do that, I have to have a modulated structure because I can't have, well, on a triangle, I just can't do this. So you end up having two spins down in the easy direction, and the third one up has to be larger. And if it's larger, then the Z component has to be different on these different spins. That's a really strange magnetic structure. It actually costs energy to modulate the Z component of the spins. It comes through from this. This is an effective ferromagnetic term, but anyway. And that cost in energy ends up favoring, as the spin in the Z direction grows, ends up favoring a case which is still modulated, but where the moments in the XY plane rotate now, have a larger value in the easy direction, but have some value in the hard direction. And the when you turn on the interlayer coupling, just like the previous case, that's just going to turn this from a two-thirds pi wave vector into something that's slightly different. And this is then the origin of these two different phases. This phase corresponds to this phase, the single ion anisotropy wins, and this phase corresponds to this one. The single ion anisotropy is there, but isn't, if you like, winning. So what about the dimensional reduction in this system? Barium copper silicate, you end up with these planes decoupling from each other. And that's because the in-plane wave vector was pi over A. In barium manganate, if the wave vector was two-thirds pi, corresponding to the 120-degree structure, then this would also be perfectly frustrated. But it's not. The wave vector isn't exactly equal to that. And there's actually a very good just reason based on symmetry for that, which is if you look at barium copper silicate, if you look at this perfect BCT lattice, there's a planar inversion symmetry. And if there's a planar inversion symmetry, that means you can only introduce terms which are quadratic in K if I do a sort of a small angle expansion around the minimum of the triplet dispersion. And actually, you can just look at this. This is now a calculation of the triplet dispersion. Red is high, blue is low, around the minimum of the dispersion relation where we then turn on the interlayer coupling. And you can see it stays nailed in this place. Symmetry causes it to, forces it to remain there. And because the wave vector, the in-plane wave vector is still pi over A, the layers decouple. In the case of the triangular lattice, there's no inversion symmetry. If there's no inversion symmetry, you can introduce terms which are linear in K in the dispersion. And you can see that here, this is now no interlayer coupling, and turning on the interlayer coupling, the minimum of the dispersion moves away from this value, and you therefore get a three-dimensional spiral. So to bring it back, gosh darn, the triangular lattice ends up being less frustrated than the square lattice, at least in terms of the decoupling of these planes. And one will therefore always find a three-dimensional incommensurate spiral in this case, whereas in this case, you can have this dimensional reduction. Just in the last minute, you might ask, what about the quintuplet states? Here's the magnetization versus field. Here's the triplet condensate. Here's now the quintuplet. Well, this is bringing the triplet down. Here's the quintuplet band. You can look at the resulting ordered states. This is one of the more beautiful phase diagrams I'd ever seen. This is temperature versus field. These are then the triplet states, singlet triplet condensation, and these are the quintuplet states. And you can understand this entire phase diagram using a very similar treatment to what I've shown you just now. The only difference is that the effective Hamiltonians you write down, the transformations are slightly different. You have to go back to your Clebsch-Gordan coefficients to see why that is. But just because the states that make up the S equals 2 quintuplet and the S equals 1 triplet are different. So I hope I've persuaded you that spin dimer compounds give access to some very exciting physics and some quite beautiful and exotic magnetic structures. Barium copper silicate was the example where the layers decouple from each other based on this BCT lattice. And barium manganate with the triangular lattice, which you normally think of as being more frustrated, ends up being somewhat less frustrated. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.
Time for one or two quick questions.